crystal keepers, gym lovers, and rock hounds. Welcome to There's a Rock for That. This is the show that is all about crystals, gems, and rocks of all varieties, where we will explore the folklore, metaphysical properties, and healing applications of the stone people. I'm Pterodactyl, and I welcome you all. Whether you're here to connect with the Crystal Kingdom, or discover what your rocks are about, or even sail the mystic seas to the land of dragons where fairies greet us and unicorns gallop through magical forests to sacred stone temples, I'm so happy that you are here to share the experience. Well, we are going to be going into the mystic a little bit today. We are going to be reviewing the Tarot of Gemstones and Crystals. Now, this is a deck that came out in 1997, actually, from Admuller Neuhausen Press. And they're out of Switzerland. And the deck is available on Amazon.com and also on their website, tarotworld.com. So you can check it there if it ends up interesting you today after we talk about it. And our crystal guest today that we'll get to a little later in the show is Moonstone, a very mysterious and fascinating stone. So let's get to it. First of all, before I do get to it, I do want to thank everybody who tuned in on Sunday to my appearance on Positive Perspectives with host psychic medium Melinda Carver. That was a lot of fun. We really had a lot of a real blast. We talked about all kinds of things, crystals and tarot readings and people, just people, what it's like to be a person. And we took some great calls too, so that was a lot of fun. And if you missed it, you can find it on Blog Talk Radio in the archive for Positive Perspectives radio show. All right, so this is actually kind of an interesting tarot deck, this Tarot of Gemstones and Crystals. And it comes with a little white book. And it's the one thing, I think probably the very first thing that caught my eye about it was the back design, because there's no design, so to speak. So if you're someone who, like, says, you know, reads reverse cards, you know, when the card is upside down, a lot of times what happens with tarot decks is that the back designs will be so creative, and they won't always be reversible. Like, you'll be able to tell right away by looking at the back of the card if it's upside down or not, because of the way the design is. That is not the case with this deck at all, because it is just a plain, kind of a pale green color on the back of the cards, which is interesting because, you know, if you so desired, you could actually kind of create your own design on the back of the cards, I guess, with the marker if you wanted to or something like that. But yeah, they are extraordinarily plain on the back, which also means that they function very well if you want to use reversals. Now, the interesting thing about these cards is each card has a photograph of a crystal, or actually there'll be, you know, maybe several, you know, examples of that crystal in the photograph, and the photos are quite lovely. And so along with the photograph, you have the name of the card. Like right now I'm looking at the Seven of Wands, and at the bottom it's the Seven of Wands and the stone, and then the name of the stone associated with it. In this case, it's a zoisite with ruby, which is, you know, kind of interesting, you know. And we've talked before about associations with tarot, you know, between what the correspondences could be between crystals and tarot cards. And, you know, I have seen so many different systems for that. You know, I think what the earliest I can think of is probably starting with Scott Cunningham's in his book of Crystals, Gems, and Magic. He has a whole section there of assigning crystals to tarot to kind of make your own crystal tarot, which has, he just actually works with the 22 major arcana cards with that. So, I mean, but that, it, you know, it's, they're interesting, you know, correspondences, and he even says, you know, if these don't work with, you know, for you, substitute ones that do work. And then you have other decks, that, you know, the Crystal Tarot, is another deck that is associated, the correspondences between crystals and tarot cards, and that is a full deck, and that's, I think that one is by Philip Permit, and that actually has the depictions of, I mean, it's pretty much based on the Rider-Waite in the artwork, and then we'll have crystals incorporated into the illustrations and associate a crystal with each of the cards. And, you know, I think I even had, who was it, Janet Boyer, I think, wrote, I don't know if she's published it yet, but she was a guest on this show, you know, months and months and months ago, over a year ago, I think. And she came on and she was talking about the crystal associations that she came up for her book on tarot. And there's lots of other decks and books out there that have correspondences between crystals and tarot cards. And pretty much, there are some similarities, but there's a whole lot of differences, especially when you get into the minor arcana and even the majors too. I mean, there's some that maybe are pretty clear cut. I think almost in every book or deck I've looked at, moonstone is associated with the moon. And often sunstone is associated with the sun. And so those are kind of easy to guess that they would make those associations. And yet, you know, a lot of the other ones are kind of surprising. The thing I like about this deck in particular is the it actually has a really kind of interesting little white book that comes with it that I feel is kind of a little bit different from a lot of little white books that you get with your tarot decks. And, you know, it may actually say some things, you know, it says some things that are pretty different than I've seen in other little white books. And even just the ideas, you know, like some things are kind of the same, you know, in the beginning of it, in the introduction of the book, they talk about, you know, just the minor arcana consisting of four groups or colors is how they say it, which, you know, they're talking about, you know, the elements basically, you know, and they say wand symbolizes energy and the fire element, cups symbolize emotions and the water element, swords symbolize the mind and the air element, coins symbolize the material world and the earth element. Well, that's pretty common. You pretty much find that without, that's a pretty accepted way to look. You know, it's just a very, you know, not too deeply at the minor arcana and those four suits of cards and make those associations between the elements and those particular suits. And then it goes on to get a little bit odd, you know, odd by comparison, because the book goes on to talk about the pip cards, basically, and the aces, you know, and the pip cards, those are the numbered cards in the minor suits, in case you're not that familiar with tarot, that you know, I'll just put that out there. But in the book, they say that the aces symbolize opportunity and strength, which is, you know, kind of interesting. I think a lot of people see the aces as you know, symbolizing opportunities. They say the twos in the minor arcana symbolize impulse and conflict, and that's kind of different actually from what most people you know, seem to, you know, have a consensus about when it comes to the twos. The threes, they say, represent balance and understanding. That's kind of different too. The fours symbolizing order and realization. You know, I think a lot of people would agree with the order association with for the fours, and the fives represent change or crisis. It's an interesting way to put it. Often you see people talk about the fives, you know, representing conflict or challenges. But change or crisis, I mean, a crisis is definitely a challenge for sure. I'd say the sixes represent mediation rather, and transition, which is a little bit different. But when you think about the Six of Swords, I mean, there's definitely a transition depicted in that card, you know, kind of where you're going from rough waters to smoother waters. The Sevens, they say, represent success and battle. I don't know. You know, I haven't, you know, success, you know, I could kind of see if we're talking about the Chariot card, but when you look at the Seven of Cups, it doesn't really seem like a card of success so much. I guess if you make the right choice or choose the right option, I suppose it could be. And they say the Eights represent structure and letting go, which is kind of interesting. It's hard to quite wrap my head around that. Again, the Eight of Cups, I could see that as, you know, maybe representing letting go, you know, moving on to something better, leaving something behind. The Nines representing completion and pause. And, yeah, a lot of people see the Nines as representing completion. And the Tens representing new beginnings and abundance. I can see the abundance, absolutely, when you think of, like, say, the Ten of Cups or the Ten of Pentacles, new beginnings. You know, maybe the Ten of Swords, if something's coming to an end and, you know, then that means something else is going to begin, maybe. I don't know. You know, those even just the number associations are kind of different, you know. And then they go on. And, you know, that regardless of, you know, what your take is on what the meaning of the cards are, what the meaning of the suits are, the number cards or whatever, it's kind of nice to have it laid out in one of these little white books because it's usually not gone into that much, really. And they even go into the four court cards, saying kings represent dominion and masculinity and community, and the queens represent wisdom, femininity, and power. Knights representing willingness to take risks and action, and the page represents willingness to learn and silence. So that's kind of going to be a wild one for people to wrap their heads around. The idea of pages representing silence, I think, is kind of something I haven't seen anybody make that connection before, really. And so I think it's good that they lay it out because then, now that you know kind of what their philosophy is of just the very basic structure and aspects of the tarot cards, then it shines a little more light into why they've associated certain crystals with certain tarot cards. And then the kind of cool thing that they say is a special feature of this particular tarot deck, the Tarot of Gemstones and Crystals, is that the cards which have been drawn can also be used to resolve the situation or respective task by using, carrying, or wearing the stones or metals described. So they suggest that you actually do that. So say you get the Temperance card on a situation that you're dealing with. And in this deck, Temperance is represented by rose quartz. So maybe you carry rose quartz around with you or wear a piece of rose quartz while you are dealing with the situation that you asked about in your reading. So I think that is kind of a fascinating way to approach things that, you know, definitely, you know, not every tarot deck is going to work in that way because they won't have those associations with stones. So it's, you know, it's a little bit different. And so basically, you know, the way that the book, you know, they have the section where they have an explanation of each card. And how they do that, let me give you an example. Actually, let me find Moonstone, since we're talking about Moonstone later on. Let me find the Moon card here. Okay, the Moon. So they say Moonstone, and it starts with a description of the stone or crystal. It says, the Moonstone has a very calming and balancing effect, making us more conscious of our feelings. It shows our feminine, passive, dreamy side, which is often neglected. Our intuition benefits from this stone. So they start out with the little paragraph about the stone, and then they do an interpretation of the card, what it could mean in a reading. Tarot interpretation, dreams, change, feeling, passion, night, sleep, calming, fantasy, hidden problems, dreams, feelings, or information arising up from the unconscious mind into the conscious mind, exploring hidden fears. And then the last paragraph for each card is the shadow aspect. And for the moon card, they say the shadow aspect is weak will, chaos, fear, disappointment, betrayal, falling for deceptions, susceptibility to addiction. So, again, you know, those interpretations are kind of interesting. A lot of it, you know, I think a lot of tarot readers and writers and creators would agree with a lot of these aspects. And it kind of like they throw a lot of different kind of keywords out there, basically. You know, and as we know, when we read tarot, it's not always, you know, the same card isn't always going to mean the same thing over and over again. I can't tell you how many times I'm doing a reading for someone, and it'll be someone who actually has a deck of cards and, you know, will do readings for themselves. And a lot of times these are people that have learned certain key words that they associate with each card. And there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody's got to start somewhere, right? The problem is that a lot of times they don't go beyond that, you know. So I will be, you know, all I have to do is say the name of the card that comes up, because I always tell people, you know, I do most of my readings over the phone, and I let them know what cards come up on their question, and then we discuss them and how it relates, what advice there is for them. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll just say, you know, Seven of Wands, or, you know, the Chariot card or something. And the person, if they have their own deck and they've just memorized some key words associated with each card, will say, oh, courage, oh, victory, oh, ruin, you know, depending on what system they actually learn. Because, look, you know, there isn't one system of tarot either. As we, you know, most of us familiar with tarot, we know that, you know, there is the Rider-Waite deck, which a lot of other decks are based on, you know, so the imagery will look very similar. And then you have the Thoth tarot that was created by Aleister Crowley and Lady Frieda Harris. And then you also have people that read Tarot de Marseille, which, you know, depending on, I mean, there's a lot of arguments in the tarot community as well as to, you know, what is the better system for reading, and, you know, who had the better artwork. And, you know, don't ever get in a big argument with a rabid Pamela Coleman Smith fan, because you'll never get out of there. You know, and she, of course, was the illustrator, the artist that Arthur Waite worked with in creating the Rider-Waite deck. So, you know, or the Waite-Smith deck, depending on which version you have. So there's a lot of room, you know, for not just interpretation, but also for style and when it comes to the tarot. There's no one right way. And, you know, I'd like to also, you know, say that there's no wrong way. There are some people that just read intuitively. There are some people that, you know, read, you know, own, you know, system that they learned, maybe, or they've developed their own style of reading, or they follow a certain school of thought, you know, or have gone to a tarot school and learn to read a certain way. And, you know, ultimately, either it makes sense or it doesn't. Either it's accurate or it isn't, right? You know, and that's the thing that, you know, so often when we talk about tarot cards, you know, and I've been on a lot of tarot forums and tarot groups and been in tarot associations. And it's really kind of an interesting thing. You know, every time a new deck comes out, you'll have a lot of people that'll be like, how does it read? You know, can I read with it? Or I can't read with it, or nobody can read with that. Deck's a train wreck. I mean, people have like really intense, like they do about everything, really intense feelings about different decks. And, you know, this deck in particular, I like to talk about not the bright new shiny decks all the time. Of course, I talk about those too, but I'd like to talk about maybe the ones that, you know, don't really get talked about very much. And this is one of them. And I think that this is a good one to kind of explore, because you could have a lot of purists, per se, that depending on whether they are, a Tarot de Marseille reader or a Thoth reader or a Rider-Waite devotee, you know, they're going to look at a deck like this, you know, and either just be totally turned off by it, or maybe intrigued by it, you know, because there is no imagery. You know, you see a lot of people when they review tarot decks, they talk about, you know, number one, you know, are the pips illustrated or not? The numbered cards in the minor arcana, are they illustrated or not? You know, so they're looking for those similar depictions to either the Rider-Waite or to the Thoth deck. Unless they are a big fan of the Tarot de Marseille, which, you know, really, those are pretty much unillustrated pips. There's some flourishes. And what you have when you have an unillustrated pip card, you have, like, the number of the suit. So say you've got the Seven of Wands. Well, you'll have seven batons or wands, you know, seven sticks, basically, depicted in the imagery for that card. But there won't be any people in it doing anything. And that was kind of, you know, that's kind of why the writer, Waite, how Arthur Waite and Pamela Coleman Smith sort of revolutionized tarot and brought it into the modern age, really, is by illustrating those pips and giving us scenes or imagery that would depict what the meaning of the card was. So with the Seven of Wands, you have this guy standing there, and he's, we say he's on the higher ground. The figure is positioned kind of above what you can imagine or all these other figures, but you don't really see them. You see all these sticks coming towards him. So you have like six, you know, wands coming towards him, and he's holding a wand to kind of, you can see that he's in this defensive position, or he's holding the higher ground, or he's defending himself. And so when you look at that imagery, you kind of get it. Right? I mean, and that's the beauty of the illustrated pips, you know, revolutionizing a modern tarot. With the Tarot de Marseille, you don't really have that. You can maybe sense a bit of the tension in the way that the wands themselves are positioned, but you really kind of have to learn the meanings of the cards, because you're not going to get it from the imagery. Well, that's the fascinating thing about having a deck that just uses pictures of the meaning of a certain, you know, tarot card, because you don't have anything except pictures, a picture of the crystals. And for that reason, probably more than any other, I really feel like this is a stone for people who already, or a stone, this is a deck for people who already have an understanding of tarot cards, that they already have an understanding that they've just kind of absorbed of what the cards represent and of what they mean, you know. And otherwise, I think that, well, I mean, I guess I could go one of two ways. Otherwise, you're going to be totally lost, because you'll just see the word Seven of Wands, and you'll see a picture of, you know, stones, and it's not even 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, it's a picture of seven pieces of zoisite with ruby on this Seven of Wands card, and also a big piece in the background of a raw piece of zoisite with ruby. So you actually have, you know, 8 separate stones in there, examples of zoisite with ruby. So it could be even more confusing of why some are bigger than the other and why there's 8 pictured there instead of 7. So it's a kind of, you know, it's kind of one of those things that you're just, you know, you're not going to maybe do a regular tarot reading very easily with this deck unless you already understand or have associations in your mind with what, you know, the title of the card is and what that card actually represents. Now, that being said, like I said, it could go one of two ways. Either it gets really confusing and really hard and people have to think, what do I remember about the tarot card? What does it mean? You're just a total clean slate and you look at it and maybe develop your own meaning from it. And maybe that meaning's close or not, you know? Maybe that's okay, even if it's not. But in that case, are you really reading tarot? I don't know, you know? I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. You know, and that leads me to why I think this also, you know, it functions as an oracle deck. I think it really could function as an oracle deck for people that maybe are, say, super, you know, aware of symbolic meanings that they, you know, have associated with crystals or and the energy of crystals, or they're just a total blank slate. And, you know, they are making it up as they go along, and then it's functioning more as an oracle card, or oracle deck, rather, than anything else. So, I mean, it's kind of a fascinating deck in that way. I like it, personally. Like, I don't forget what a tarot card means. I've been reading, you know, I've done thousands of tarot readings at this point, so it's not something I have to, you know, it doesn't take me out of the moment of connecting during a reading to have to try to physically recall what a card means. And to me, the stones associated, you know, kind of add something more to it. So I think if you're a seasoned tarot reader, I think this, and you like crystals, I think that this is a good deck to get, really, you know. You know, if you don't mind not having any traditional tarot imagery at all and just having pictures of crystals. But, yeah, if you're a beginner, if it really speaks to you, then go for it. But you might try, say, something like Philip Permit's Crystal Tarot, which does have kind of the classical Rider-Waite imagery, only with some extra, you know, little sparkly depictions of crystals contained within the scenery. That might be an easier jump. But then, again, what happens is you do that, and then you say, okay, you know, and then I want to try this other deck. And then the associations change between the crystals and the tarot cards, and you start thinking, like, what? So, I don't know. I guess, you know, in a sense, you could have too many decks, or maybe you should just stick with one. Or maybe, you know, what's wrong with exploring these different things and seeing, like, which ones you actually enjoy reading with. So, taking a look at, you know, just what some of the other associations are here, the Fool card, and this is just kind of funny to me. The Fool card in the Major Arcana, rather, is associated with Silex. Now, that's a word you don't hear very often, you know. You know, even in the crystal community, you don't hear people talking about Silex, S-I-L-E-X. And I just was like, what? You know, and if you look in, it describes it as Silex is an activating stone which connects with the earth and calms the restless mind. It balances out feelings which are too intense, such as anger, jealousy, and hate. It strengthens the self in its creative expression. So it's kind of a interesting thing because they talk about, you know, what, how the stones, you know, maybe what the metaphysical properties or healing properties of are of the stone, but they don't give you very much information about what kind of stone, what the minerals content is or anything like that. They only can give you the hardness. They just say it's a grounding thing. And silex, S-I-L-E-X, the word itself is really kind of a... an older word, you know. It used to mean flint, you know, and then later meant like any kind of sort of, hard rock, you know, just like a hard rock, specifically flint a lot of times, and is now thought to actually represent a stone that's been ground up. Like finely ground silica or silicate, and it's just unusual to actually kick off this tarot deck with that first stone being silex, very unusual, but then the Fool card, the energy of the Fool card, it's surprising, right? It's unusual, anything can happen, and so and maybe it's even more appropriate, the more I think about it. And then from there, just taking a look, this is a major arcana, because I'm sure you don't want to hear me tell you all the associations of all 78 cards, right? I don't think we have time for that. The magician is Herkimer Diamond. The high priestess is Aventurine. The empress is Emerald, which to me that like totally fits. And I've seen other people associate the Empress with Emerald, too, which is kind of interesting. The Emperor with Purpurite. The Hierophant with Diamond, which I don't know why. I found that kind of fascinating. The Lovers with Ruby. The Chariot card with Sugar Light. The Justice card with Terminalin. And the Hermit with Lapis Lazuli. The Wheel of Fortune with Alexandrite, Strength with Onyx, the Hanged Man with Aquamarine, the Death card with Amethyst, which kind of surprised me, and the Timbers card, like I mentioned before, with Rose Quartz, the Devil with Snowflake Obsidian, which that's pretty, I don't know, that surprised me too, the Tower card with Calcite, and the Star card with Moldavite, which that made sense to me. It's a meteor stone, the Star. I could see that. The Moon, of course, with Moonstone. The Sun with Sunstone. Judgment with Ametrine. And the World card with Watermelon Terminalin. So I thought, those are some interesting associations. The rest of the deck, a lot of these are stones that maybe, just were kind of surprising to me, because I just hadn't seen these being kind of used a lot in other decks, some of them, and then some of them you have a lot of the usual suspects, but they're not necessarily representing the cards that you would expect. So, all in all, the photographs are beautiful. And the back design, like I said, it's just one color. It's plain, but it definitely is reversible if you like to use reversals. So it functions in that way. And the other interesting thing about the book here is that not only do they have they have a few spreads as well that they include in here. The good old Celtic cross is there and pretty much laid out. And they have a couple short spreads. I think they have a 4-card spread. And let's see. It looks like they've got... Okay. Yeah, it's hard to tell. Let's see here, because these little white books that the printing is so small. They do spend a lot of time on formulating the question, which that's something I'm a huge fan of. You know, it's like what, you know, we say the more specific the question, the more specific the answer. And that's why a lot of readers don't like to do general readings, you know, where it's like, oh, just tell me whatever. It's like, why are you here? You know, it's like if you had a question that you wanted a reading on, that's something a lot of readers can understand, you know. But if you just want a general reading to, quote unquote, see what comes up, it's something that a lot of people just can't deal with. They're like, no, I'm not doing that. And I know a lot of readers that refuse to do those. I don't really refuse to do those general readings so much because I think it's kind of fun, you know, because I do a lot of readings that are very, very specific, sometimes even very narrow questions, and I think it's a little bit refreshing when somebody's like, let's just see what happens, because it's kind of my approach to life sometimes is let's just see what happens. So, you know, but I do really believe that you get a more accurate reading if you do ask a specific question. And, you know, they talk about it, the way they put it in here, it's important to formulate the question as clearly and precisely as possible. Don't ask any questions which can be answered with just yes or no, which I appreciate them saying. You know, readers, we get a lot of yes or no questions, and it's like, why don't you flip a coin or use a pendulum? Why are you going to tarot reader for that? You know, because it's not really how the tarot works. It's not necessarily designed on its own to be read to answer yes or no questions. Now, there's a lot of people that would disagree, and what they do is they use a yes-no spread. So maybe they use like maybe five cards or something, and they will, you know, put five cards out on the table and say if three of them are what they feel are positive cards, then they'll take that as a pretty good chance that the answer is yes. If they get, you know, three or more cards that, you know, are, you know, cards that they would feel would indicate a no, like maybe the Tower card or the Three of Swords, or, you know, some of the cards where the energy is you know, not favorable generally, then they would say that the answer is no. And I think the easiest way to handle that is to rephrase the question and just do a regular reading, however you read the cards. But, you know, the book does go into that, you know, and they give some suggestions. They say, you know, ask, you know, what will happen if, should I blank is what they say, even though that's a yes, no, what will be the effect of, what's the next step? So those are all good ways to formulate a question for tarot reading. And they say it's best to write out your question. Well, you know, if the person you're getting a reading from is paying attention, then you won't need to do that. But I guess if you're reading for yourself, that might be interesting. If, you know, a lot of people journal when they, a lot of tarot readers and writers like to journal and, you know, keep a journal of the readings that they do, personal readings that they do for themselves generally. And, you know, you always write down the question there and you write down the cards that came up and, you know, the positions and how you interpreted it. And then over time, you can kind of see the threads of certain things kind of develop with that. I always recommend tarot journaling. I think that that is a really rewarding and helpful thing, especially if you are kind of new to tarot cards. That allows you to kind of, you know, really, really learn them in a way that you're not going to learn in a book, you know. I don't know about you guys, but for me, I always learn better by doing. And if you keep a journal of it, you see how you've interpreted the cards, you see how they play out. You know, it's always great to ask a question about something that's, you know, maybe a few months out. Like you could in July, you could ask, you know, where am I going for Christmas, you know? And then, you know, write down, you know, do the reading, write it down, and then, you know, just kind of leave it alone until December rolls around and see if, you know, the cards came up, you know, truly indicated, you know, what your holiday was going to be like or where you were going to go for it. And if not, the interesting thing is to look at those cards and see if you might not have been able to interpret them in a different way that would have been reflective of the truth. Because, you know, the thing about it is that a lot of times, you know, it's not that the wrong cards come up, you know, but sometimes our interpretation can be a little bit off until we've had a lot of practice with it, you know, and things, you know, are always surprising, and regardless of how long you've been reading tarot cards, there's always much more to learn, and that's what, to me, makes it so fascinating, you know. Sometimes they can be very, very blunt and to the point, and sometimes they'll be speaking metaphorically, and it's only through experience that you encounter all those different things, you know. I think that that's a big part of why there's so many different keyword meanings for each card, and sometimes they seem to kind of conflict. You know, the few that I read out of the little white book here, you know, even just on Moonstone, seem to, you know, kind of conflict after you know, the 10th keyword. You know, and that can happen. You know, sometimes when you're reading tarot cards, it's not about those little things that you've memorized or what you think you know the card means. A lot of times it's about being in the moment and being present. And, you know, the question generally is pretty important because that has a lot to do with the meaning of the cards that come up. You know, if you ask a question about a relationship and a certain card comes up, it might have a certain meaning in that context and also in relation to the other cards that come up. But if you ask a question about your job and that same card comes up, it could, you know, the meaning's probably going to be different, you know. The Lover's card is a great example. You're asking about a relationship and the Lover's card comes up. Depending on what position, if you use a positional spread, that Lover's card could represent the couple in question. It could represent the relationship. But if the Lover's card comes up while you're asking about your job, it's not indicating that you're sleeping with your boss, probably. It could be. But it may represent a choice that needs to be made when it comes to that job or that position. So something to think about there, you know, just an easy example of how the same card can come up and mean, you know, really, really different things. Depending on the question being asked or what the reading's about. All right, well, we are going to take a short pause for the cause here to hear some great messages from our network, and then when we come back, we are going to explore this week's crystal guest, Moonstone. We'll be right back, everybody.
Schedule your reading with one of the psychics at Attune. Psychicsatattune.com. Have you always wanted to create your own tarot or oracle deck but thought you needed to be a graphic artist? Self-published decks are really hot right now, and I could show you how to do this. No Photoshop required. Contact me, Mary Nail, at marynail@attunemagazine.com.
www.theresarockforthat.com. Visit the website where there's a stone for that, an idea for that, a story about that, and even a reading with solutions for that because, well, we just happen to rock like that. Need to relax? Or raise your vibration? Want to know how gems, crystals, and rocks can enhance your life? Get a crystal consultation. For entertainment purposes only, crystal consultations do not in any way replace treatment by licensed healthcare professionals. Come explore the wonders of the Crystal Kingdom at www.theresarockforthat.com.
Welcome to Attune Magazine Radio.
All right, we are back, and you are listening to There's a Rock for That on the Attune Magazine Radio Network. All right, and if you have not checked it out yet, you need to go to attunemagazine.com and check out the July, August, September, I think it covers all 3 months issue of Attune that is now out there. Really fascinating issue. It's got fairies and unicorns and crystals in it, and great interview, cover interview with Melinda Carver, psychic medium, host of Positive Perspectives, which I was on Sunday. All right, so let's talk about this week's crystal guest, Moonstone. So what is moonstone, right? Well, moonstone is actually a type of feldspar, you know, and it's probably one of the most popular of the feldspars. It's thought of as having a, you know, when you look at it, they call it a moving cloud of light effect in the stone. They actually call it adularescence, A-D-U-L-A-R-E-S-C-E-N-C-E, I believe. And it makes it kind of stand out from other feldspars. It's actually caused that effect, which some people refer to as chatoyancy as well, is caused by tiny crystals of albite that are layered within the stone. The stones themselves are usually cut as kind of a high domed cabochon, to kind of concentrate that sheen as a bright spot on the top of them. You'll see that with moonstones that are cut for jewelry. And it may also form kind of a band of light as well. Can even look kind of like an eye. And those ones that actually do look like an eye are called cat's eye moonstones. And the thing about moonstone that's really interesting, in fact, what's funny is I was talking about this on Positive Perspectives radio show with Melinda, because she asked me what was going on this week on this show, and I told her we were going to be talking moonstone, and she asked me like an interesting question. She said, you know, how do you can you tolerate moonstone? Kind of funny, because it's not something everybody talks about, but yeah, there are some people that have a little bit of difficulty with certain kinds of moonstone. Like, it affects them, like, physically. I'm actually one of those people. I can't handle the blue moonstones. Like, I love them. I think they're absolutely beautiful. The moonstone comes, you know, in a variety of colors. But the ones that are blue, for some reason, I'm always, like, running to the bathroom, you know, probably too much information there, but, you know, with the idea of kind of like the moon affecting the tides, you know, I felt like the blue moonstone affected, you know, the liquid in my body, you know, like me, like a tidal kind of energy. I know it's peculiar, but anyways, and she, I think she couldn't really handle the blue ones either. There's a lot of people that, you know, have that effect. Now, rainbow moonstone, I love. I have pieces of that and kind of the white moonstone as well. And those don't bother me at all, just the blue ones do. So it's kind of an interesting thing, you know, that, you know, it may not affect everybody. But for the ones it does affect, you know, you definitely... You know, we talk a lot about whether, you know, whether we can feel the energy of a stone or not. And moonstone was probably one of the first ones where I was like, oh, yeah, I can feel this energy. It's not working for me, you know. But on the other hand, my son absolutely loves blue moonstones. So anytime somebody gives me one, I pass it on to him. And I gave him the ones that I had. You know, the folklore of moonstone is kind of interesting. I mean, it was used as a talisman, actually, to cure insomnia, and a lot of the literature that there is about moonstone is usually a retelling of just a single attribute that was recorded by Pliny the Elder, and he had said that the stone was known for shining like with a yellow luster from a colorless ground and containing an image of the moon, which daily waxes and wanes according to the state of the luminary. So according to what phase the actual moon above us was in, you would see that reflected in the moonstone, okay, which is, you know, kind of, boy, is that fascinating. And everybody else kind of just kept retelling that story. You have Marbodus, you know, that's telling that later, and then in the 16th century, you have Meisold, who also describes that as well. He talked about performing experiments on a moonstone that was owned by Pope Leo X, you know, and this is in the, you know, late 1400s, early 1500s, and that he meticulously recorded the changing size and position of a point of light in the stone and concluded a direct correspondence existed to the lunar cycle. So it's not like this was just something that, you know, the Pliny said and everybody was like, yeah, okay, we'll just repeat that. No, we're going to conduct experiments to, you know, validate it. So I thought that was wild. And so I would say if you happen to have a moonstone, you know, that does have that point of light or kind of, you know, you feel like you can see the moon in it, look for that to change. You know, pay attention to what the current lunar cycle is. Why not? I haven't done it, but I'm saying, like, why not? You know, this guy's going to do it, you know, for Pope Leo. Why, you could do it with your own moonstone too. Moonstone is a sacred stone in India and is thought to actually bring good fortune. And the thing about it that I found kind of interesting, it's only displayed in the gem markets against a yellow cloth because yellow is considered a particularly sacred color to the Hindu. The moonstone has remained a prized gift for lovers. It's said to arouse passions and give lovers the power to see their future together. The association of moonstone with lunar cycles is said to make it a powerful talisman for women and their reproductive organs as well. So, you know, it comes, there's, you know, this thing that has come from that connection to women and sexual organs, basically, that has given it the properties when it comes to health healing applications of being useful to ease childbirth, to enhance fertility, to promote pregnancy, to relieve menstrual discomfort, and to increase lactation in breastfeeding mothers. The stone serves modern gym therapy practitioners as a tool to enhance feminine energy and to heal emotional distress. And along with its abilities to bring calmness, it's used to treat degenerative conditions of the skin, hair, eyes, and fleshy organs. So I think, you know, of course, you know, any time that we talk about the healing benefits or using crystals for healing, you know, I always like to mention that I think it's good to think of it as a complement to getting the proper diagnosis from a licensed medical professional. That's a good way to start. And then use stones to help speed up the healing process or to support you on an emotional or even spiritual level. So just putting that out there. Taking a look at what Judy Hall of Crystal Bible fame and a recent guest on our show has to say about the healing aspects of moonstone. She does talk about the digestive and reproductive systems, that it can help assimilate nutrients and eliminate toxins and fluid retention, and can, again, alleviate degenerative conditions of skin, hair, eyes, and fleshy organs. This is something that is, you know, a lot of people feel that it's very helpful for. And again, you know, with the idea of it being helpful with relieving PMS and helping one to conceive and helping you get through your pregnancy and easing the pain of childbirth and with breastfeeding, that she backs all that up too. And it's traditionally used for insomnia and has been used to help prevent sleepwalking. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And you know, she recommends you either wear it as a ring. You do see a lot of moonstone rings out there. Or place it on the appropriate body part. You can put it on your forehead for spiritual experiences. And solar plexus or heart for emotional help, to help balance your emotions. And she says, I thought this was so interesting, she says that women may need to remove moons the full moon. So that is something to keep in mind, really, because I do think that it is one of those stones that can actually be pretty effective, meaning you can really feel the energy of it. So, you know, you might, again, you know, I think, you know, with moonstone, we got to kind of keep track of the lunar calendar, actually, which is kind of interesting because most stones, I don't necessarily feel that you got to do that. But moonstone is a little tricky in that way. On the psychological level, moonstone can calm overreactions to situations and to emotional triggers. Moonstone is filled with receptive, passive, feminine energy. It can balance male-female energies and aid men who want to get in touch with their feminine side. So it can be a perfect antidote for the excessively macho man or overly aggressive female. So I think that is pretty cool. And, you know, ultimately, it's such a beautiful, beautiful stone anyway. So I think that moonstone is really worthwhile to check out. And I do think, you know, the Tarot of Gemstones and Crystals is too. So that's pretty much it for today, for our show this week. I hope that you will all join us next week for another exciting episode. We are going to be having our open line show, so you can call in with your questions or get a free mini crystal reading. We always have a lot of fun on those shows. I hope I see you next Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. I hope you all have a lovely week until then. Bye-bye, everybody.